Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to an episode of Table Talk. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted this week to be joined by Fuchsia Dunlop, a writer and cook who specialises in Chinese cuisine, especially that of Sichuan. She was the first Westerner to train as a chef at the Sichuan Institute of Higher Cuisine in Chengdu, and is the author of 5 books, including the autobiographical Shark's Fin and Sichuan Pepper. Welcome to our podcast.
Hello.
So let's start at the beginning, where we always do. I suspect we're not going to get to the real Sichuan Chinese bit for a little period. What are your earliest memories of eating?
Well, I grew up in a household that was filled with international flavours. So my mother has always been an extremely adventurous cook, and she was a teacher of English to foreign students in Oxford. And so we just had constant streams of Iranians, Turks, Japanese, Lebanese, Sudanese coming over to cook and cooking dinner parties at our house and leaving recipes behind. And then my mother would go on cooking them. So I really had a very unusual diet for sort of 1970s England.
what sorts of dishes were they cooking?
The Japanese did sukiyaki, I remember, and the Turks made kofta on a barbecue in the garden, and zhujuk, the yogurt and cucumber dish, and the Sicilians made pizza and parmigiano.
What a childhood!
Yeah.
And were you open to all of these things? Were you fussy about any eating when you were little, or did you just go for it?
Well, again, I mean, my mother always says that when she was pregnant with me, her grandmother gave her a subscription to the Cordon Bleu magazine. And so she was cooking adventurously, within mainly yeah. European tradition. So even before I was born, I was sort of being fed on the essences of all this.
That's quite a kind of heritage.
Yeah. But she says she remembers that the first time I had actual solid food, this expression of total rapture passed over my face, which she's never forgotten. So I think I was always very, very interested in eating. But of course, like any child, I would play up. My sister and I would sort of have, standoffs. There was one famous standoff of the lentil curry when we refused to eat it. And then we were made to eat it and then loved it even more. But my mother had this very cunning strategy, which was that we were allowed to have 3 things that we did not eat, but we weren't allowed to change them often.
Right.
They had to be fairly well established, and we had to eat everything else. And she was very good at blackmail and bribery and sort of, when there was something we didn't want to eat, she would suddenly remember she had these lovely chocolate puddings, but they were only available for people who ate their vegetables.
And it worked.
It did work. Yeah, so we did grow up eating adventurously. And then, of course, I just loved cooking, and from a very young age.
And were you being taught to cook by these exchange students who were passing through?
We used to cook with them, yes. And then we actually used to have one student staying in our house often as an au pair. So I had a Japanese girl living with us when I was very small who used to make rice balls for breakfast and cut these rabbit apples. And then we had Turks living. But my mother sort of very much encouraged me and my sister to participate. So I can remember being very small and sort of standing on a chair stirring things, and then she would encourage me to sort of see if something needed a bit more salt and then later really teaching me to cook properly, and it just always made me extremely happy.
So it sounds like meal times were really important to your family. There's a real community there, particularly if you've got other people staying with you and people coming and going in the dinner parties that you mentioned.
Yes, yeah, and we always ate together, and yes, and we did not have a sort of English nursery diet or whatever.
Funny, because most people do say they've had an English nursery diet, so it's quite unusual to hear someone say.
We used to have Sunday lunches, which were quite traditional, and then we'd have shepherd's pie from time to time, but a lot of it was foreign, yeah.
And what about school food? That must have been quite different to what you were having at home.
Yeah, school food was like, what was it? Was it semolina and jam and toad in the hole and things like that?
Yeah. And there's still semolina is one of the few things that I think I haven't quite managed to get my head around and find a positive
side of. I
think
you should do one of your columns on semolina.
Yeah, maybe that's the way to do it. Maybe I will convince myself. But I feel like schools are not really encouraging children to like food if they are serving semolina and jam as their pudding of choice.
And did you have Chinese exchange students coming through at various points?
No, not at all. And the only Chinese food I had growing up was the occasional takeaway. And it was those deep fried sweet and sour pork balls with an absolutely unnaturally red sweet and sour sauce, which we loved.
Yeah.
And things like, you know, chicken stir fried with tinned bamboo shoots and egg fried rice and spring rolls, those big spring rolls lots of bean sprouts in them. And that was what Chinese food was. And I think probably in Oxford, they were just, you know, a couple of takeaways serving Anglo-Cantonese food. So I didn't have proper Chinese food until one of my cousins had a Singaporean Chinese girlfriend when I was a teenager. And I remember she invited us for dinner at her house once, and it was a revelation, and it was so incredibly delicious. And then my cousin and she invited me for dim sum in Chinatown. And I remember, I can't remember exactly how old I was, but I must have been a teenager, and it was all delicious, but I was very conscious that, I mean, I was already quite serious about cooking, but I just didn't know what anything was. I mean, there were these sort of glutinous and slippery textures, like, you know, chengfen, the sheets of rice pasta rolled up around prawns and things like that, that they just had textures that I hadn't really experienced before, and I had no idea how they'd been made.
Tell us about the path that took you to China. It was initially journalism, is that
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
Well, so, I mean, I did a degree in English literature and meanwhile cooking quite seriously all the time. And I did want to do something with food. But I ended up having a job as a sub-editor, and I was sub-editing all this stuff about East Asia. And that's where I first got mildly interested in China. And I went backpacking to China for a month and found it really interesting. And I went to Hong Kong, where I had a cousin working. And then I went to Guangzhou with its amazing market with all these live creatures. And very interesting. And then I went on a boat through the Three Gorges. And I went to Beijing, and I was very interested. And I came back, and I started evening classes in Chinese at the University of Westminster. And that's how it went on. And then I applied for a British Council scholarship to spend a year in China. And I chose Sichuan partly for food reasons.
That's a good reason.
Because I'd been there, and I'd spent a few rather rapturous days in Chengdu with a Chinese musician and his wife who I'd met in Oxford. And they took me around, and it was just delicious. And it was a sort of magic place. It still is Chengdu. It has a very captivating atmosphere, and it's sort of charming. And on that trip, something happened, and I remember sitting in a tea house on the last day and thinking, I'm going to come back and live here. So anyway, so I applied to Sichuan University, and, you know, I was supposed to be doing something academic, but the food was more interesting. And so I just, right from the first few weeks, since a teenager, I'd always kept a notebook, and it always ended up being recipes and menus and like descriptions of food. So I carried on doing that. And then there was a particular favourite local restaurant, the Bamboo Bar. And I asked the boss if I could sort of study in the kitchen a bit. And he said yes. So I spent some days just observing. And then a German friend and I heard about this famous cooking school. And so we just went over there and persuaded them to give us some private classes. And then when I'd finished at the university, the cooking school invited me to they just had a professional chef's sort of training course starting. And they said, would you like to join in? And I just said yes.
And that's of course where you were the first Westerner to be trained at that institute. Tell us about the experience of cooking there. I mean, it must be very different to, we have a lot of people come on here who've been professionally trained in different ways, but none of them have been trained at a Sichuan Institute of Cookery.
Yes.
What were the realities of it?
Well, so it was totally in at the deep end, because although I spoke, you know, decent Mandarin after a year of being in China and a bit more of private study, the classes were all taught in Sichuan dialect, which is a sort of stretched form of Mandarin, so it's rather different. And the textbooks were all in Chinese. And there's a whole vocabulary of cooking, which is not what you learn in school, and it's not, you know, different characters for all the cooking methods and ingredients and things. So, and I was in a class with 50 young men and two women. and just learning the ropes of such Chinese cooking. So it was, I mean, in retrospect, you think, that was mad. You know? But at the time, I mean, it was just fun. And life in China, I can't tell you what a different place it was then, because China was just opening up and most Chinese people had not met foreigners before. There were very few foreigners in Chengdu, a provincial capital. And so life was just full of fascination and novelty on both sides. So I think for Chinese people, it was just extraordinary to meet foreigners, and we were just weird and quite... intriguing. And then for us, the foreign students, life in China was just, you know, surreal, and extraordinary things happened every day, and it was so interesting. So just going to cooking school and being the only foreigner and stuff was just part of a very unnormal
landscape.
And what distinguishes Sichuan cuisine from other Chinese cuisines?
Well, the obvious thing is that it's spicy, and that's the stereotype. So if you're going to Sichuan, Chinese friends might say, "Ni pa bu pa la, are you not afraid of chili heat?" So that's the stereotype. But actually, it's far more interesting than that. And the real sort of heart and soul of Sichuanese cooking lies in the sort of audacious and varied mixing of flavours. And they often say, "Yi cai yi ge, bai cai bai wei," which means each dish has its own style, and 100 dishes have 100 different flavours. So any good Chinese meal is a balance of strong flavours and gentle flavours, and dry things and wet things, and, you know, different cooking methods and shapes. That's a good Chinese meal. But in Sichuan, you get at one end the electrifying tastes of chili and Sichuan pepper, and then all different kinds of chili. So dried chilies, which are often sort of scorched, so they have a wonderful sort of wok fragrant aroma, and also chili oil, which they call hongyo, red oil, which gives this gorgeous sort of ruby red luster to cold dishes, and also pickled chilies, which are not that hot, but they have this amazing scarlet color and a sort of fruity heat. And they're all mixed up in different combinations. You know, we learnt 23 official flavour combinations. So one example is yu xiang wei, which is fish fragrant flavour. And it's called because it uses the seasonings of traditional fish cookery, although there's no fish in it. And that is pickled chilies, ginger, garlic and spring onions, and a bit of sweet and sour. And so that's, you know, it's got a bit of heat, but it's not really hot. And it has this complexity that is very Sichuanese and very exciting. So you just do Sichuanese meals. They are so exciting and varied. But they're not all hot, because you almost always have a very mild soup to refresh the palate. And you might have some simple stir-fried greens and plain rice and pickles, you know.
Mm. And were there any sort of flavours or ingredients you found particularly hard to get to grips with?
Yes, the main thing, and I think this is the main issue for Westerners wanting to appreciate Chinese food, is texture, mouthfeel, kogan, mouthfeel, literally. Because the Chinese just appreciate a far greater range of textures than Westerners typically do, including some textures that most Western people find revolting, like gristly, slithery, slimy textures. And not only that, but it's also just there are quite a lot of foods which are really just about texture and not about anything else. So when you serve them, you mix them in a sauce or something. So something like jellyfish is essentially totally flavourless. And also very expensive things like shark's fin and fish lips. So these are dried delicacies which require extraordinary labour. They have to be soaked and purged and purified, and then you cook them in a beautiful soup or something. But they have no taste. And in fact, part of the process of cooking is taking away the xingwei, the fishy taste. Mm-hmm. So you're just left with pure texture. And that's something that, when I first went to Chengdu, for example, Sichuan hot pot, when you sit with friends and you... this bubbling cauldron of chilies and you cook your own food by swishing it around with chopsticks. But a lot of the favourite things to cook in a hot pot in Sichuan are gristly bits of offal. So goose intestines, tripe, aorta of pigs, which is really rubbery and gaunchy. And so I was brought up to be very polite in English and eat everything. But I didn't enjoy them for years. I would just eat these things. Very nice. And then at a certain point, I just turned a corner and I found that I was ordering them myself. And now I really, really love texture foods. And in fact, one of my favourite recipes in the new book It's so delicious. It is beef tendons. And they're slow cooked and they're sort of gelatinous and slippery, and they make your lips sticky, and they're totally divine. So that's something that I would never have enjoyed before. I would have recoiled from, and now I really like. And I always say to people, like, if you want to fully appreciate Chinese food, really, you really want to try to get your head around the idea that there is pleasure in texture, because it's not necessary, because there are plenty of delicious things in Chinese cuisine for any palate. You don't have to, but there's always going to be a whole lot of dishes that you just won't get unless you can change your mindset and start looking for pleasure in the way things feel in your mouth.
You said in, I think in your memoir, that when you went to China, you were going to eat what was put in front of you, and you said that, you know, brought up to be very British, and thank you very much, That's lovely, I won't have another. Was there anything you physically couldn't stomach or couldn't eat? Have you had to say no to anything?
No.
Really? That's very impressive.
The thing is, okay, you know, when you're faced with something, I think it's a very natural reaction, you're faced with something alien and disgusting, and you feel disgust. And then maybe if you're wanting to try, you know, you try it, and then eventually you realise it's fine. Mm. And with me, this was particularly influenced by the fact that I think the Chinese understand good food better than anyone. It's the seriously developed gastronomic culture. So my inclination is, if Chinese people think something's good, then it must be good.
They know what they're doing.
I better sort of apply myself to it. Yeah. But the point is that moment of disgust, and then trying and overcoming it, and then realising it's fine. Once you've done that enough times, you don't even take that moment seriously anymore. I mean, somebody gives me something weird and I just say, okay, chuck it in my mouth, you know, and it doesn't faze me anymore.
Yeah.
So I would say, though, that so culturally I have no barriers, but I do try to avoid things that one shouldn't eat for environmental reasons,
right,
like shark's fin, for example.
Yeah. Mm.
But that's not because I don't enjoy it. It's just because...
That's an ethical choice.
Yeah.
And do you think Brits are becoming more adventurous when it comes to Chinese food? I mean, we were talking earlier about, obviously, the kind of classic takeaway. I mean, in the last 20 years, people sort of become a bit more open-minded.
Absolutely. And I think you can just see that, like in London, the number of Sichuanese restaurants. And I think particularly that people who are interested in food will seek out pig's ear and tripe and duck tongues for the adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, they're exciting and a bit different. And I think also, you know, there's the Sojourn effect of bringing offal back into fashion probably has some effect. I wouldn't say that everyone will eat these sorts of things. But I think definitely, you know, Sichuan pepper, when the first edition of my book came out, was unknown here, really, because the only Sichuan pepper you could buy was very dull Cantonese supplies. I mean, the Cantonese don't need Sichuan pepper for the zingy taste.
Right.
And so there wasn't good Sichuan pepper. So even food writers and chefs had not tasted the Sichuan pepper that makes your lips sing and tingle.
Whereas now it's on a cardo.
Yes. Yeah. So I think definitely. And I think that the whole idea that Chinese food is some simplified takeaway menu has been shattered by, you know, the new growth of regional Chinese restaurants. Yeah. And I think also that just British tastes in general are more adventurous, like, you know, sushi. I don't think 20 years ago you would have thought English people were going to have raw fish for lunch, you know.
No, you can get that in Sainsbury's.
Yes.
And where do you go in London or around the UK if you want to get really good Sichuan or broader Chinese food?
Oh, well, I have to admit that I'm very spoilt because I spent a lot of time in China, so I don't need to, you know. The Royal China Club dim sum lunch is one of my regular haunts, and it's excellent. I really love the new Xi'an street food places, Master Wei and Xi'an Impression. The chef is a friend of mine too, but they're great. And then for Sichuanese food, Ba Shu, which I don't work for them anymore, but I worked with them for about 10 years. Also, very interesting, like, have you been to Liu Xiaomian? It's a Chongqing noodle place. It's a pop-up in a pub in Marylebone called the Jackalope.
Mm.
And it's a couple of young women from Chongqing, and that's really spicy noodles. And it's delicious.
Sounds really
good.
So
the menu is only about 3 dishes, but that's really good, and it's really, you know,
there's
really
a great
Chinese
restaurant called, have you come across Chili Koo?
Oh,
which
yes.
Which is by King's Cross, which is so kind of unassuming from outside, but has really yummy Sichuan food.
Yeah.
When it comes to the Sichuan province itself, you say in The Food of Sichuan, writing a cookbook that attempts to encapsulate the cuisine of a place is like pitching a tent on quicksand, because places change and people change, and it's been 20 years since the original version of this book came out. So how have you approached the changes in the Sichuan province and in their cuisine in updating the cookbook?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was bring in more regional Sichuan recipes and not just to focus on Chengdu.
Right.
And I know chefs in Chengdu who have travelled around the south of Sichuan bringing in regional flavours and recipes. Mm. So I was keen to reflect some of that diversity within the province. So there are recipes from like zigong, rabbit eaten cold, a really delicious spicy appetizer, and a tofu dish from Leshan, where the giant Buddha is, and other dishes from places outside the capital. Mm. And then there are some dishes that have just become supremely popular, like superstar dishes in Sichuanese cooking, like shui zhuyu, which is sort of slippery poached fish in a sort of great basin of chili oil, chilies and oil. Mm. So that has become one of those dishes you can't not have in a cookbook. Yes, and also I think I put in a few more of the sort of simple vegetable dishes, which I love, like very plain soups of just like boiled pumpkin. That's all. And it's so lovely.
Yeah.
And is there a kind of classic Sichuan comfort food that everyone would have grown up eating?
Yeah, I mean, I remember once writing a feature about three exceptional Sichuanese chefs, and I interviewed them all separately, and I asked each of them, which is your favourite dish? And they all said, hui guo rou, twice cooked pork. And I think that is the Sichuan sort of supper dish. So that's very fat pork, and it's a particular cut of the rump, which is half fat and half lean, although you can make it with belly very well. As so the meat is twice cooked because it's first boiled, and then when it's cooled, it's sliced and stir-fried with chili bean paste and fermented black beans and traditionally green garlic stems, which look a bit like something between spring onion and leek. Mm. And it's so delicious, and it's really xiafan. It sends the rice down. So it makes a very good meal. You just need a bowl of plain white rice and this gorgeously aromatic pork and the green vegetable. So nice.
And Fuchsia, just finally, I mean, you wrote a piece recently where you gave advice about how to order in a Chinese restaurant. For listeners who might want a bit of guidance on this, what advice would you offer?
Well, I think the main thing is that, I mean, as I wrote in that piece, you have to exercise some benevolent dictatorship. If everyone in a party of people simply orders the dish they fancy, you are going to end up with a chaotic and unbalanced menu. Like, you might end up with several chicken dishes or several sweet and sour dishes or everything deep fried. That is not a good Chinese meal, because a Chinese meal should be a harmonious whole, which leaves you feeling very shufu, very well, very sort of comfortable. And so you have to have a strategy. So, you know, either one person or a couple of people in discussion working out a sort of plan. And the main principles are sort of contrast and the avoidance of and balance and the avoidance of repetition. So if you have a chicken dish, then maybe the next dish should be fish. If you have something that's dry and fragrant and deep fried, then you should perhaps think of ordering a soupy dish or a soup. If one dish is cut into slivers, the main ingredient, then maybe the next one can be big chunks on the bone. And if this dish is very dark in colour because it's braised with soy sauce, then perhaps you want something vibrant green. So it's just trying to think about all the elements, like composing a piece of music or a picture that is balanced. And what that means is that when you help yourself to morsels from each dish, never becomes repetitive. So you have something rich and heavy, and then you have something very light and refreshing, then you have something sweet. And so it becomes a sort of marvellous journey of contrasts, and it never is never cloying. And a lot of Chinese people find Western food very jian dan, very simple, very dan diao, monotonous, because it's just the idea that you just have a big piece of meat and you just munch your way through it, and then some potatoes, in comparison with a Chinese meal where you're sort of dipping into all these different flavours. It's very difficult. So, and I think, as I said in the piece, in the past, it was almost impossible for Westerners to order well because of language problems and not really knowing what the food would be like. But I think the fashion for picture menus has really helped. So a lot of Chinese restaurants do have pictures now. And so you can see if something's bright red with chilies or if it's green or, you know, the cooking method. But that's mainly the idea, that you just try and avoid repetition.
Fuchsia, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. Fuchsia's book, The Food of Sichuan, is published by Bloomsbury and is available in all good bookshops and online now. Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.